I think ULI is, I think it was misguided. I think it was misrepresented. The fact that it was called a mansion tax targeted at a wealthy homeowner selling a $5 million plus home was just misleading. And I think that really underscores, I think, what people don't like about some of our overall system. It just wasn't truthful. And so today, at $150 million of raise, that's 300 units. Think about how many units that's killed because of a developer's redlining of Los Angeles. It's already difficult to develop in Los Angeles. So all of a sudden, then, to put a transfer tax on, which every developer's got to now bake into, that there's a lot of development leaders in our community that have said, I give up. It's hard enough.
Good morning. This is Deconstruct, a podcast from The Real Deal. I'm Isabella Farr.
I'm Susanna Cavanaugh. It is Monday, April 15th, and today we're airing a supplement to our closing for April. That's our interview with Lou Horn. Isabella, tell us about Lou Horn.
Yeah, so we decided to run a little bit of an extended version of the closing. We're doing a little trial here, so let us know if you like it. But Lou runs CBRE's operations in LA, Orange County, and across the Inland Empire. And we touched on a lot: the office market, his family, LA's transfer taxes, and his relationship with one-time mayoral candidate Rick Caruso, who also built a lot of malls out in LA, who he considers his best friend. So it spanned a lot, but a really, really interesting conversation for sure.
I think the closing is my favorite MAG installment because those Q&As, they often give you a full scope of what these real estate players' lives look like outside of their day jobs. So you get to the heart of, you know, who these people are more so than the hard news.
Yeah, absolutely. We went back, you know, Lou was talking about his time in college. He talked about how he wanted to start a retail pet business. He never even thought he would be in real estate. He also talked about some of the grief that he suffered over the course of his life. It is an opportunity for us to get personal with some of real estate's largest players. So we'll get into that in a bit. But first, here's the news of last week.
Let's start with the new color we got on the Meridian saga. So the brokerage is currently under investigation by Freddie Mac over a deal it did for the agency. And while the probe is ongoing, Meridian is blacklisted from brokering deals on Freddie Mac's behalf. That's huge because Meridian is one of the country's largest commercial real estate brokers, and Freddie Mac, by the same token, is a go-to lender for multifamily.
And with that recap out of the way, senior reporter Keith Larson schlepped it out to suburban New Jersey last week, where Meridian CEO Ralph Hertzka was speaking with RXR's Charles Hariri at a re-deal conference, just a note that has no affiliation with The Real Deal.
So the two did not touch on the Freddie ban, but Hertzka did say it was a challenging time for his business. He also said things were on solid ground. Meridian closed $4 billion with 99 lenders in 28 states in the first quarter, according to Hertzka.
He also made some generalized comments about loyalty.
Right. So he said, and I'm quoting here, "I learned who your friends are and who they aren't. You can do something for someone for 20 years and it doesn't mean anything. Truth prevails," he said, "and the good people always come out on top."
Do you also want to talk about what happened with NYCB on Friday?
Yes. So two top executives are out at New York Community Bank. John Pinto, he's the chief financial officer, was, and John Adams, president of commercial real estate. The general counsel at the bank, Patrick Quinn, is also exiting. That's a big deal because the bank has already lost two CEOs in the past 6 weeks, or turned over two CEOs, I guess we could say. And that comes as NYCB reported a surprise loss in the fourth quarter. It axed its dividend. It forecast more distress would hit its multifamily loan book. And it also disclosed weaknesses related to internal controls of internal loan review and said those came from ineffective oversight. So the bottom line here is that its share price is down substantially. It was around $10, I believe, early this year before the fourth quarter earnings at the end of January. Now it is, we're recording this on Friday afternoon Eastern, it's, $2.80 is about where it closed at.
And I'm just going to give a little shout out to ourselves. If you want a little bit more information about NYCB, we did an episode digging into the bank in February. So give that a listen for sure. On to Blackstone. Blackstone is set to close a record multifamily deal. The investment giant agreed to buy AIR Communities, that's AIR Communities, for about $10 billion. The Wall Street Journal had that scoop first. AIR stands for Apartment Income REIT. The firm split off from Aimco in 2020, and it owns rental communities along the coast. So think Boston, LA, Miami. In California, it owns 8,300 units. So that's what Blackstone is picking up. Blackstone is also planning to spend about $400 million to renovate AIR's properties. I think what's most interesting about the deal is that it speaks to Blackstone really getting back in the investment game with the understanding that rate hikes seem to be coming to a close. It's also a huge bet on multifamily.
Right, which is an asset class that has had problems depending on which markets you're in, what type of properties you bought over the past few years.
And what sort of financing you used to buy it.
Yes, famously. Blackstone reports earnings on Thursday, so we should get some more details on what they're looking at for 2024, investment-wise, what sectors they're bullish on. So switching over to residential. In New York, Naftali and Rockefeller Group were both sued by a construction firm for allegations that the developers owe about $15 million for work on an Upper East Side condo project. And that condo project has raked in more than $550 million in sales. So the property is 200 East 83rd Street, and the construction company, that's Leading Builders Group, claims Naftali and Rockefeller purposefully stopped paying as the project was wrapping up. So at first they made partial payments and then they paid nothing at all. LBG, the construction company, wants $15 million plus interest and attorney's fees, and it's seeking to foreclose on a number of liens it filed on the property.
Did Rockefeller or Naftali have anything to say about this?
Yes, they did. They said LBG didn't finish things up on time and abandoned the job, and the developers had to finish the work themselves. They actually sued the contractor in September for damages. And if you like the Secret Synagogue tunnels story that came out of New York a little bit ago, you'll love this Bay Area secret apartment story, which West Coast, Isabella, that's your domain. So tell us about these covert train station apartments.
Yeah, this story seemed to blow up on Reddit. But two railroad workers in the Bay Area allegedly executed two office to apartment conversions in two train stations south of San Francisco. I love that, you know, how difficult office to apartment conversions are. They actually managed to do it. And all of this happened right under the nose of Caltrain, which is the California commuter rail that serves the San Francisco Peninsula and Silicon Valley. Neither train station is currently being used by the public, which is probably why these conversions were possible. Regardless, both workers face felony charges for misusing public funds.
Yeah, so who are these guys?
So they're two 60-year-olds. One's a former Caltrain deputy director, Joseph Navarro, and a contractor, Seth Andrew Warden. They were both fired. But I think the reason that social media was a fan of this story was, number one, housing is notoriously expensive to build in California. And they really converted these offices in the train station into their own apartments. Navarro installed a kitchenette, a shower, plumbing, and security cameras for $42,000, apparently without anyone noticing immediately. The story also highlights how rough commutes can be in the Bay Area. The San Mateo district attorney said the apartments were a convenience for the workers because the workers figured that the Bay Area commute was, quote, really lousy.
So it's innovative, but also a felony.
Yes, I think that anyone looking to turn offices into residential should probably go about it a little bit more legitimately. But hey, they made it work.
All right, let's leave it there and let's turn to your interview with Lou Horn.
So Lou, thank you for being here. First, can you just take a second to introduce yourself?
My name is Lou Horn, and I'm the president of the Los Angeles, Orange County, and Inland Empire region for CBRE. And I was born on a missile base in Santa Maria, California, in Central California, way back when.
Your parents were in the military?
My father was in the military. He was an Air Force officer, a pilot, actually. So we spent the vast majority of my younger life moving from town to town based on where he was stationed. I actually found that moving every 2 or 3 years was really an excitement for me personally. Now, I have three brothers. One of them was a year younger, and he had a little more difficult time getting to know people, but it really trained me to go into a first grade or a fifth grade classroom and figure out how to make friends quickly and then how to build relationships and then ultimately have a great experience there. And then 2 or 3 years later, we were gone to the next town. So I actually enjoyed the life. We moved. We lived in Hawaii. We spent time in Virginia. We spent time in Northern California, Southern California. We would go up, and my parents actually met in the territory of Alaska. So they were married there, and we would go back up to Alaska to visit that base, but then also my grandparents were up there. So I really had the opportunity to see a lot of the country, not just from a tourist standpoint, but from a place where we actually had friends and family.
So tell me about when you first settled into LA.
We were living up in Sacramento, California, and I was going to college up there and ultimately wanted to start a small business down here. So USC was starting an undergraduate entrepreneurial program, and so that really caught my eye. I drove down here in my little orange Volkswagen and interviewed for the program and ultimately got in. And so really my first adventure in Los Angeles was moving down here to attend the university's entrepreneurial program, which I graduated from in 1980, but ultimately moved down here, met a lot of my friends, lifelong friends, my closest friends, who I still have today, and ultimately had an incredible experience in just 2 years of college, and ultimately made this my home. Mm-hmm. Met my wife here, raised our children here, and have built my life here.
Tell me about USC. Did you study real estate at all as part of that program? You know, there are so many real estate people that went to USC. I feel like every, you know, agent or developer or anything, you know, that I meet is like, oh, I also went to USC.
You know, it's funny. I knew nothing about real estate, and that was not my intention. What SC did for me more than anything was elevated my aspirations. I met people here that had such lofty goals that it was inspiring to me. So I got to know the professors that I went to school with, who I became friends with, and then a lot of my closest friends, my dearest friends. You're impacted by the company that you keep, and I think that was the case when I went to SC and graduated.
Got it. What was the business that you wanted to start?
It's kind of funny, actually, as I look back on it, but it was a retail pet business. And so I was up in Northern California running a small company, and then ultimately thought, then I actually was offered a partnership with that, and I thought my dad really wanted me to finish college. I had no intention. I was going to drop out of college at that point and go into this pet business. And ultimately, my dad convinced me that it would be much wiser to finish my degree and maybe start something new. And so ultimately, I came down to Southern California. I built a business plan. And my intention was really to start a big pet chain down here, and ultimately wound up, my first job was with IBM. So it couldn't have been further from the pet business, yeah. Which at IBM, I met a lot of friends, that, and one of those friends ultimately introduced me to, at that time, Coldwell Banker after 4 years. And one of the biggest risks I felt like I've ever taken was leaving IBM, which I loved.
Can you talk about what you were doing, what your role was?
So I was selling accounting systems and payroll systems and hardware and software to manufacturing, and distribution companies in downtown Los Angeles. One of the jobs that I had was really selling to the produce market. So I'd get up at 4 a.m. when they were all trading, but I would try to talk these owners into computerizing their inventories. So, because listen, if you've got a big truck full of strawberries, you got to move those in a couple of days. Otherwise, you've got bad product. And so we had, you know, I remember dealing with a guy that sold apples, and I didn't realize there were 40 different kinds of apples. So we persuaded people to actually go through inventory, build a software program, manage their inventory more effectively, and therefore, ultimately be more efficient in the way that they were running their businesses. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, that's what I did.
That doesn't sound all that dissimilar to trying to get users into space and, you know, getting companies to say, okay, maybe like update your leases, or, you know, maybe you need this modern warehouse. Can you talk a little bit about that?
One of my friends at IBM, an individual by the name of Bill Chillingworth, had left. His father was a developer, and he had left IBM to go to Coldwell Banker and out in the San Fernando Valley. So he called me one day and said, Lou, you really need to do this. This is, it's a fun position. You're focusing on solving problems and dealing with clients, and it's much more entrepreneurial, and there's greater upside. So I had a series of interviews at that time with Coldwell Banker, and then became a broker out in the San Fernando Valley for my first 12 or 13 years of my career.
Can you talk about a deal that from that time, you know, when you were first starting out, that has really stuck with you over the years?
Well, I remember in those days, one of my accounts was with the New Holland and Farming Company. I had a great partner, Doug Sonderegger and Craig Peters. We did a lot of work with the New Holland and Farming Company. We did a lot of expansion work out in the Simi Valley, Moore Park, Chatsworth, Canoga Park area. I remember once finding a large parcel. I think it was like 300 acres or so. And it was an engineer owned it. We ultimately put a deal together, and the city of Santa Clarita was a brand new city. We thought that would be a great headquarters site. And so we put the whole deal together, we presented it to the city, and ultimately the city manager agreed. They acquired the property. And I just remember I felt like I was playing some role, and my team felt like they were playing a role in changing the landscape of a community. And so to me, it was incredibly rewarding to be able to come up with a vision, to execute on a plan, and then ultimately to see buildings and warehousing and office or residential get developed from an idea that we had come up with.
How did you meet your wife?
So I met my wife at USC, and she was, in those days, there was something called a pinning. And so you would get pinned, and she was in a sorority, and my brother-in-law today, Don Gorsch, was in my fraternity, and they were getting pinned, which meant that all of my fraternity brothers went to her sorority, and we saw them out in the front of their lawn, and there was this ceremonial. It was kind of a pre-engagement kind of a thing, and I spotted my friend Don's sister, Lisa, and I said, you know, it was kind of, I was starstruck, and I said, I'd really like to meet her. And so he set us up on a date, and then ultimately, I want to say maybe a year or 18 months later, we were married in a double wedding. And so I'd never been to one since, never had been to one up to that point.
Who was the other couple?
It was my brother-in-law today and my sister-in-law. We got married in Los Angeles, and it was, my wife is one of seven girls, so she was number four. Lori, her sister, was number three in line, so she got married 15 minutes before we did.
And then you had kids.
So we had four children, and I'm very proud of them. My oldest daughter works for Newmark, and her name is Laura Stumm, and she's done exceptionally well. I'm very proud of her. My second daughter works for Rick Caruso. She does some of his high street retail, and also their pop-up strategy she's engaged with. And Rick is my closest friend and is somebody that Christina grew up with. And so that's been wonderful. And my youngest daughter is a young aspiring attorney who is working with an employment firm and is graduated from actually the Rick J. Caruso School of Law in Pepperdine, which I'm really proud of. My son, a little over 20 years ago, tragically died. And so we went through that process. It was a pretty big change in our family and something that we all got through, but something, you know, very, very proud of him. He was 15 and a half years old, and it was just a very tragic event.
And I hope you don't mind kind of talking about this, but I know that Rick Caruso was one of the people that was there for you in that time. And you still call him your closest friend. He's obviously a big part of LA with his mayoral campaign. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your friendship.
Well, Rick and I have been dear friends for almost 50 years. So, and Rick is somebody that has just been, you know, with me and with my family through thick and thin on multiple occasions, and just somebody that I really hold dear, and I consider him my best friend, and somebody that I just am fortunate to have met. He was really one of the first people I met at USC. And he was one of those that I pointed out to you earlier that had just such high aspirations on what he wanted to do in life that he motivated me. And I just found him to be, even as a young man in college, he was a natural leader at that point. He was somebody that was, he was the president of our fraternity. He ran multiple organizations at USC. He was really considered well beyond his years and his stature and the way that people looked up to him. And he was just somebody that I've always really cared for deeply, but respected immensely. Rick is somebody that, you know, when we were, of course, at that age, we were kind of moving through life with a compass, not a map. We really didn't have, you know, very specific direction. We all knew that we wanted to raise families. We wanted to be successful in our lives or our careers, whatever they turned out to be. And I don't think anybody really had any idea that we would all wind up in, I mean, a lot of us wound up in real estate. Mm-hmm. That was a circuitous route. It was not something that we had planned on, certainly at that age.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to get into the city of LA is struggling with homelessness and crime, or perceptions of both. There's also, you know, office market struggles and the fact that a lot of buildings in downtown LA are struggling with, you know, 40 to 60% vacancy, and a lot of companies deciding, we're in Century City right now, a lot of companies deciding, no, we want to move our offices to Century City. Talk to me about some of the biggest issues that you see face LA today.
Well, that's a lot. And so let me break it down.
Yeah.
On the homelessness issue, I do believe, and I've made this comment in the past, that LA has got so much going for it. And that's an area where we really do need, we need more resources. We need a shift of attitude. Basically, our homeless population constitutes about 0.5% of our population. So you would think in the most innovative and the richest and strongest communities in the world, we could figure this out. Mm-hmm. And I think what we have done as a company is we've really taken this on as a corporate responsibility and to play a role. And not any one person has the answer, but a big part of the answer is real estate. We need to figure out how to shelter the unsheltered. And then obviously we need to match that up with services to help the addicted or to help the mentally ill. Our corporate leaders need to play a more active role. I do think that there's a role for the public and the private partnerships to make, mm-hmm. to help in solving this problem. I do think we need an orchestrated, specific, targeted goal. At a personal level, I had a brother who died in an encampment up in Northern California. So when I'm looking at that homeless, unsheltered person through Skid Row or just somebody panhandling on the street, that person has a mother, they've got a father, they've got a brother, they've got a sister. And they don't want to be there, and they didn't, who knows how they got there. But I do think we have a community obligation and to play a role to fixing this. It is a shame that people are being treated this way, not just in Los Angeles, but in other large cities. And I think we just need to do more at a public and a private level, and a more orchestrated effort to come up with a fix. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk about Measure ULA because it was, you know, we talked about this at the September Forum for the Real Deal. But it was something that was in theory designed to provide revenues for the construction of affordable housing. For you're giving me a thumbs up. You know, it's collected a tenth of what it was projected to. I think the lost numbers were $157 million.
I think ULI is, I think it was misguided. I think it was misrepresented. The fact that it was called a mansion tax targeted at a wealthy homeowner selling a $5 million plus home was just misleading. And I think that really underscores, I think, what people don't like about some of our overall system. It just wasn't truthful. And so today at $150 million of raise, that's 300 units. Think about how many units that's killed because of a developer's redlining of Los Angeles. Now, I think that's got to be repealed. I think it was misleading. I don't think it was honest in the way that it was brought into law. I think, and I know there's an effort right now to repeal it. I would support that effort. And I think if elevated to the right people who really had a clear understanding of what the cause of what is creating the cause here relative to the amount of money that's being raised versus the issues that are driving development away. It's already difficult to develop in Los Angeles. So all of a sudden then to put a transfer tax on, which every developer's got to now bake into, that there's a lot of development leaders in our community that have said, I give up. It's hard enough. But to have to deal with that is just something, I think it's just outrageous. And I think it should be repealed. I mean, I think I feel really strongly about that, right?
I would definitely say so. I mean, I was actually looking at US Census data, and Florida in the year 2023 had double the amount of new residential permits. It has half the population of California, and it's upwards of 200,000 residential units. I think California as a state had just over 100,000 units.
Well, we have one of the most creative and innovative development communities in the world. Mm-hmm. You think about the buildings that are built here, and you think about the investment that's made in Southern California, even in downtown Los Angeles. Drive down Grand Avenue. I mean, how many cities have two Frank Gehry buildings right across the street from each other with extraordinary culture and whatnot? But when you continue to just take the development community for granted and think that you can continue to tax, I mean, ultimately, they have got to make a reasonable profit. And they're generally, the entitlement process isn't a year or two. In some cases, it can be 5 years. Mm-hmm. And so I think we've got to, let's repeal ULA. Let's get some of these barriers out of the way. Let's go through CEQA reform, and I realize that's a state issue. But let's start taking a look at what do we need to do to regain the trust of the development community to be building again in Los Angeles. And if we properly incentivize the development community, and if we lower some of these barriers so that they can build the incredible need that we have right now in housing. And by the way, let's not restrict them on what to build. You build any kind of residential right now. Ultimately, if we build a Class A building, it will ultimately cascade down into more inventory, which will create lower pricing. So I think we need to just open up the development gates and let the developers develop, particularly in that multifamily space. Because right now, you got to have the right developer with the right division. You've got to find land at the right pricing. And then you've got to have capital that believes ultimately that the projection or the performance that's going to occur on that site is going to give them their capital back with some reasonable rate of return based on the amount of risk that's taking place. When you put too much risk into a deal, your capital's not going to show up. The developer's not. They're going to look at other communities where they know they can make a bigger difference and there's more certainty of close.
I wanted to talk about the office market. Downtown LA, there have been a number of buildings that have landed in default. A lot of borrowers are struggling to pay off their debt. A lot of debt is maturing. And at the same time, it's landlords are having a really hard time getting new tenants in. Can you talk a little bit about that? How you are feeling about the office market?
I think the office market is going through the biggest change, certainly, that I've seen in my career. Mm-hmm. When COVID hit, the first sensitivity was around retail and hospitality hotels. And they were completely decimated initially. And now, for the most part, they're back. Industrial shot through the roof because of e-commerce and the last mile. And there was just this massive amount of growth in the industrial, which was a direct impact, I believe, of COVID. Office really wasn't impacted. Multifamily wasn't impacted as much. But in office was not impacted until it was really the return to work. And I think because of the uncertainty on the return to work, that's had an impact with our capital markets. Now, couple that with certain market areas where investors or with in particularly lenders feel that there's going to be less of a demand, you're going to have more problems. Right now, the biggest driver on office defaults is the ability to renew an existing loan. And so that's having an impact. Now, couple that with areas where there's a perception of safety or homelessness or an environment which is not as pristine as others, you're going to have a bigger impact, a compounded impact. So I think in places like downtown where there is that narrative, we're going through a lot of effort right now to make sure that users, investors are all working off the same sheet of information. We've had the mayor involved in speaking to our investor clients. We've had the chief of police, Chief Moore, down there really speaking to what's really happening in the marketplace so that we can separate the mythology from...
I was wondering if you could, and your daughter Laura actually spoke about this on the panel in September, but how the shift in the office market, is particularly in downtown LA, has created this new type of buyer and has really opened up opportunity. Can you talk about those opportunistic investors coming in?
I think what's happening right now, because of the lack of lending capacity or interest out there, as these larger loans roll on primarily high-rise space, what we're seeing is the values per square foot are dropping precipitously. So we're seeing a building that may have traded for $500 a foot 4 years ago, today is trading in the low 100s or maybe upwards even to $200 a square foot. There's going to be a reset in that basis, which will allow those ownerships to deliver product that's going to be at a more efficient and cheaper price range. Now, what's going to be interesting is it purely price driven? Certainly, having a lower price alternative is going to be, I think, attractive to some, but not to all. I think what's going to be critical is the environment.
Do you think that we are getting close to that price reset?
There's no question about it. I mean, there's two or three trades that have occurred downtown, but I think by the end of 2024, we will have had multiple trades in each one of our submarkets where there will be a reset. It's also happening in Orange County.
Yeah,
we're seeing Orange County, some of these building trades at $125, $150 a square foot. That's a reset. Mm-hmm. Now, what's also happening, though, is that because of the lack of lending, the loans on some of these buildings are more hard money lending that are bridge loans of 3 years or 2 to 3 years of term with maybe 12% interest, so the reset's not going to be as dramatic as one might think, but there's still going to be a reset. There's no question about it. Now, the other point that I would make is that in some cases, not all cases, but in some cases, these new ownerships are not experienced landlords. So they're not used to paying the necessary dollars to invest in amenities on the building or tenant improvements to a tenant. So when you remove a professional landlord from, running a professional building, there will also be concerns with the tenant base that may not be an alternative that they want to consider. So I think that any of these new landlords that are not from this industry, they need to get up to speed very quickly as to what really is customary and expected by the tenant community and the brokerage community.
I was going to ask, do you have to stop yourself from talking about real estate at the dinner table or on a family vacation? Or
if you point to what I'm most proud of, it really is success, particularly after the tragedy that we had with our son, to be able to get to be able to raise my children in a way that feels like a very normal family, with certainly high parental expectations on our kids, but at the same time, a very loving family where we can talk about just about anything. And so we do talk about real estate. My youngest daughter, who gets probably a little tired of that because she's more of our lawyer in the family now. But we actually love talking about real estate. It's hard not to.
Okay, last question, and thank you. I think this has been really productive. What's your favorite restaurant in LA?
I would say my favorite restaurant in Los Angeles, we spend a lot of time over at Amici's, you know, and on right off of Brand in Colorado. We really enjoy that. But listen, there's so many great restaurants in Los Angeles that we spend a lot of time up. It's also in Montecito, you know, at Caruso's. We enjoy that. That's an incredible venue and an incredible experience. And Bourbon Steak, we spend a lot of time there as well. So we've got a lot of choices in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So my favorite venue by far is when I'm with my kids and my grandkids.
Deconstruct airs every Monday on Apple, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Or you can listen at therealdeal.com. For comments on this episode or on the series, or if you have a guest or idea you'd like to pitch, feel free to reach me or Susanna at podcasts@therealdeal.com. Next week, we're talking about the New York budget and what it could mean for real estate. Tune in then.